It's always a privilege to open God's book for God's people, and it's a privilege certainly to be here this morning, although I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that it would be nice if my preaching here were under different circumstances. So we all want to be in prayer for the Kleins. Also want to say up front a bit of an apology. I was sick for about a week and a half ago. And it had an effect on my voice, and it's still not back to full strength. So if the voice sounds weak, my apologies. You'll just have to trust me when I tell you it sounds a lot better today than it did on Friday. So I had the privilege to preach twice here late in the spring, and both times I chose to preach out of the book of Luke. I thought today, for a variety of reasons, I would preach out of the Old Testament, particularly out of the book of Job. And so we'll be looking at the book of Job in a minute. What I'm going to try to do this morning is, frankly, a little bit ambitious. I'm going to try to walk us through the book of Job this morning. And some of you are now thinking you should have packed, you know, sack lunches or something. I'm going to try to walk us through the book of Job reasonably quickly this morning in order to get what I take to be the major point of the book. So that's my goal. I've got a couple of texts out of Psalms that I'll read before we go to Job. If you're not familiar with Job, you haven't spent much time in it, it's not hard to find in the scriptures. You just go to the Psalms and hang a left, and it's just right there. So we'll pick up there in a minute. Before I do, however, I want to tell you about some people that I happen to know. Nancy was a mother who had just, over the weekend, packed up her youngest to go to college. And there was sadness in the house because their youngest was gone now and the nest was empty. But there was joy in the house because the youngest was gone and the nest was empty. And so Nancy and her husband, Stan, decided to take a few days for themselves and to make a trip to Colorado to go skiing. And they did that. They enjoyed it. They were looking forward to this new phase in their lives. Nancy had a routine doctor's appointment the day after they returned from Colorado. They discovered cancer. It was fairly advanced. She was dead within 3 months. Judy is a young lady. I say young, late teens. And she fell in love. And she and the young man decided to get married. Judy's family was not excited about this. They had questions about the character of the young man. And they frankly thought the decision was not wise. But Judy, knowing better than her family, went ahead with her plans. A week after she and the young man were married, they were out driving. He had been drinking, she had not, but he was driving. He turned the car over. He walked away. She didn't. The wreck didn't kill her, but it did paralyze her. And when it first happened, the doctors told her at the time, you can expect 5 years, but we can't give you much life expectancy beyond about 5 years. Well, as a matter of fact, she lived close to 50 years after. And you might say, well, what a wonderful thing, and I certainly wouldn't dispute that, but on the other hand, she was a medical anomaly. She had problems the doctors had never seen before because, well, nobody in her situation had lived as long as she had. Margaret was a young lady full of promise. I'm not picking on the women, I know, by the way. I've got a guy I'll get to in a minute. Margaret was a young woman full of promise. She had gone to the University of Chicago to pursue her undergraduate degree. She had taken her senior year off and traveled to Africa with the Peace Corps. because she wanted to spend a year giving. So she spent a year in Africa, loved the time there, enjoyed the work she was doing with the Peace Corps. But she was also excited when the end of the year came and it was time for her to return and finish her studies at the University of Chicago. She'd always loved Paris and things French. And so she decided when she booked her flight to come back from Africa to the States that she would fly through Paris. And so she chose a French airliner to fly on through Paris. The flight from Africa to Paris, her plane was blown up. They never found her body. They never found parts of her body. Nick was a professor, happened to be a professor at Yale, interestingly enough, whose son had decided to follow in his father's footsteps. And so his son had gone to Switzerland to pursue a PhD, which is no doubt akin to suffering for Jesus in Hawaii. He had gone to Switzerland to pursue his doctoral studies. Part of the reason he chose Switzerland, though, was because, like his father, the son also really enjoyed mountain climbing. And obviously enough, Switzerland was a marvelous place to be, if that's your avocation. Nick the father, gets a call in the middle of the night from Swiss authorities. "We're sorry to tell you this, but your son has been killed in a mountain climbing accident. His body's been discovered, and we need you to come claim it." Now, again, I know each of these people individually. Nancy was like a second mother to me. Judy, the woman who was paralyzed, is my aunt. Margaret, the young lady who was blown up over Africa, was one of my closest friends in high school. Nick was instrumental in my education. Now, you might think the lesson to be learned here is don't get to know Blunt, right? But that's not the point at all. And by the way, I list four of these quickly. I could keep going. This is a short list compared to the list I could give you myself. But my point isn't that I'm unusual in this regard. My point is, this is all too common. If we had the time this morning, and you can be grateful we won't take it, but if we had the time this morning, we could go from person to person to person to person, and each of us could give a similar litany. Each of us could give a similar litany, a similar list, if you will, of tragedies. By the way, something else I neglected to mention about Nancy, Judy, Margaret, and Nick. They're all believers. These are people who have trusted Christ, whom the Lord loves. And yet, they have been through tremendous suffering. Again, I don't take myself or these whom I know to be unusual in this regard. You might even say that to be human and to live humanly is to suffer. But I do want to use the occasion to ask a question, not exactly the same question that the psalmist asked. The psalmist in Psalm 13 asked this: "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me?" I'll stop there. The question the psalmist is asking in Psalm 13 is, "How long, O Lord?" Lord, I believe your promises. I know you're going to keep them, but I'm tired of waiting. When are you going to do it? That's not the question I'm interested in, although that's certainly an interesting question and worth pursuing. The question I'm interested in is similar, but it's a little different. It's not how long, O Lord, rather the question is, why, Lord? Why? Why do you allow these kinds of things to happen? Especially, why do you allow these kinds of things to happen to your own people whom you love? That's the question I'm interested in this morning. And I want to look at the book of Job because I think this is the central question of the book. It's by no means the only question that the book answers, but it is, I think, the central question with which the book is concerned. So what I want to do this morning is walk you quickly through the book with an eye toward what the scriptures have to say to this question. Now, it may be that I'm alone in being concerned and interested in this question, but I frankly doubt it. My guess would be many of you, at times at least, have the same question. Lord, why? Why did you let this happen? Or why did you allow that to happen? Or Lord, I trust you, but I don't understand what you're doing. If you have those questions, you're in good company. I'm not going to pursue this point, but I will mention, I think that's precisely what's going on in the mind of John the Baptist when he sends his disciples to ask Jesus, are you the one or are you not? I take it the point is, I don't understand what you're doing, Messiah. Help me. Maybe some other time we'll talk about that text and about the way in which Jesus responds to John's query, but today I'm interested in the book of Job. So I'm going to start at the beginning. This is Job 1:1. By the way, when I was a kid, I thought it was the book of Job. I thought there was this whole book in Scripture devoted to work. So this is Job 1:1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. And it's really important to note how the text begins. The first thing it tells us about Job is that he's blameless and upright. This is no throwaway. This is critical to understanding what goes on in the book. We'll get to it in a few minutes, but you already know, I suspect, what happens to Job. It's important to recognize when we think about what happens to Job, what he suffers, it's important to recognize up front, this is not a man who deserved what happened to him, according to Scripture. This is, in fact, a man who is blameless and upright, who fears God and shuns evil. It's an extraordinarily significant way for the book to begin. But then the text goes on to tell us two more really significant things about Job. Verse 2, he had seven sons and three daughters. Seven sons and three daughters. So not only is he a righteous man, but he's a man who has been blessed with 10 children, whom he surely loves. Why do I say that? Well, who could be called righteous who did not love his children? And then, less importantly, but still importantly for understanding what all happens, verse 3, and he, Job, owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. So the third thing the text tells us is that Job is not only righteous, Job not only has 10 children whom he surely loves, but Job is fabulously wealthy, extraordinarily rich. In today's parlance, we might talk about him as having Bill Gates-style wealth. Then verse 4, his sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes. That's important for something that's going to happen later. And they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. So sure enough, being a righteous man, when his children would gather, which they had a habit of doing regularly, when they would gather together to feast, he would make sacrifice on their behalf in case it was needed. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a bit. However, let me quickly note, so that you don't think I'm trying to dodge this point, let me quickly note that when Job comes up in conversation between the accuser, between Satan and God, it is God who brings Job up, not Satan. I'm not going to deal with that point, not this morning, but I don't want to ignore it either. What happens to Job happens at God's initiation. There's no way around that if you take the text seriously. And make no mistake, when God, who is omniscient, who knows all things, when God brings Job up in conversation with the evil one, God knows where this is going to go. I'm going to pursue that, but I also don't want to ignore it. Let me jump down to verse 13. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you." So again, this is one of those feast days. Job's children are gathered at one of their houses, feasting. Job is in his own home. And he receives this news. A servant comes and says, "It's the Sabaeans, they came and they took off with your oxen and your donkeys." And notice, by the way, they also killed his servants. I don't want to spend time on this, but if Job is a righteous man, as the text tells us, he will be, I think, more deeply disturbed by the death of his servants than the loss of his wealth. Then verse 16, while he was still speaking, in other words, that first messenger who had come to tell him about the donkeys and the oxen, he wasn't even finished speaking yet. And a second messenger arrives. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you." So one messenger arrives and tells him, "Your oxen and your donkeys all gone, and so are the servants except for me who were tending them." And before he's even done, second messenger shows up. "Your sheep are all gone. Fire fell from heaven and consumed them. And the only servant who escaped was me." Then 17, while he was still speaking. So the second messenger isn't finished delivering his message when a third messenger arrives. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who has escaped to tell you." Now, if you paid careful attention to what we were told up front, what you now know is that Job, who was, at the beginning of the day, fabulously wealthy, has lost all his wealth like that. Now, you might say to yourself, "Well, you know, it's only money." Well, forgetting the servants, okay. You might say, "Well, it's only money, it's only wealth. Worse things could happen." Well, two things about that. First of all, it's easy to say it's only wealth if it's not your wealth. And then secondly, worse things could happen? Well, yeah, keep reading. Because they do, as you well know. So verse 18, while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, so this is the fourth messenger. Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead. And I am the only one who's escaped to tell you. So right on the heels of finding out like that his wealth is gone, Job finds out far more disturbingly, of course, that his children are gone. All 10 of them at once. Andrea and I have two children, our daughter Katie, our son Andrew. I can't imagine losing either of them. We came close to losing Andrew about a year and a half ago. He's a type 1 diabetic, and one morning he didn't wake up. And if it hadn't been for our daughter discovering him in his unresponsive state, he would have died. I can't tell you. Some of you have been there, so you know already. But I can't tell you what that felt like. I remember very vividly waiting on the front lawn for the ambulance to come. I'm sure they were very fast, but it seemed like it took forever for help to get there. I can't imagine losing one of my kids, let alone losing both. I can't fathom the suffering that Job must experience here. But what's most remarkable about chapter 1 of the book is not what happens to Job. It's Job's response. For 20, we are told this. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. The tearing of the robe and the shaving of the head are signs of mourning. Look at what he does. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." And then the text closes chapter 1 with, "In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing." What's most remarkable about the first chapter of Job isn't what we're told about Job up front. It's not the conversation between the Lord and Satan. It's not even what happens to Job. What's most astonishing to me, at least, is Job's response. I would like to tell you that were I in similar circumstances, I would respond similarly. But I have my doubts, frankly. Then we move into chapter 2. Some of you are getting nervous. You're thinking, we're going to go through every single chapter this way? No, we're not. But I do want to talk about chapter 2. Verse 3, "Then the Lord said to Satan," here again the Lord is bringing Job up in conversation, "Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains his integrity. Though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason.' And Satan replies, 'Skin for skin. A man will give all he has for his own life, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face.' Satan said, 'You didn't let me go far enough. Let me touch him physically.' Lord said to Satan, 'Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life.'" Okay, you can touch him, but you cannot kill him. Which, by the way, from Job's point of view, and we know this from things he says explicitly later in the book, is not a good thing. Job explicitly says, "Lord, can't you just get it over with and take me?" So great does his suffering become that Job would rather be dead, frankly. Verse 7, "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes." Apparently this gave him some physical relief from what was ailing him. His wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, it's fashionable to be critical of Mrs. Job. I've heard sermons where people have taken pot shots at her. I'm not commending her for what she says, but I'm not taking any pot shots either. Because that wealth that Job lost, that was her wealth too. Far more significantly, those children who died were her children too. And now the man in physical agony before her is her own husband. I'm not so sure that she doesn't say this actually out of concern for him because he's in such agony. Almost as if she's saying to him, do whatever you need to do to die and end this. I don't think she says that necessarily because she doesn't love him. In fact, maybe quite the opposite. We don't know because the text doesn't tell us. Oh, by the way, here's another point you may never have thought of. She thinks, as do Job's friends, as does Job, that he's suffering because God's mad at him for something he's done. Now, just think about that in terms of the psychological and emotional pressure and pain that that must cause Job, knowing that his wife believes he did something that led to the death of his children. Extraordinary. Extraordinary situation. He replied, verse 10, he replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman." It's not a phrase I've ever used with Andrea. "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" And then the text tells us again, in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. So here again, Job's suffering increases, and yet he maintains his righteousness. And the way chapter 2 ends is extraordinary. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing those names right, but I'm fairly confident you don't know either, so I'm not going to worry about it. When Job's three friends heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. These are good friends. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. So great was his suffering. They began to weep aloud and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. 13, then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, and no one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. This is a sermon for another time. I'm not going to preach that sermon now in the middle of the one I am preaching, but I will say this. Job's friends show extraordinary wisdom. When they see Job suffering, they recognize that there is nothing they can say that is adequate to his suffering. I tell my students at the seminary, sometimes in ministry, the best thing to do is to keep your mouth shut, to sit with people and to weep with them. Sometimes the worst thing you can do is open your mouth. By the way, the troubles for Job, I shouldn't say the troubles, I mean the suffering is great, obviously, but things get riled up as far as Job is concerned when his friends start talking. There's something to be learned about that. Well, look, I can't keep up this pace and get us out of here, today, let alone for lunch. So let's skip a bit. Turn to chapter 30. I want you to feel, and this is the reason for spending some time in chapters 1 and 2, the intensity of Job's suffering. And I want to suggest to you that Job has a problem that you might not initially consider. See, like his wife and like his friends, Job And by the way, like many people around us today, Job has what is basically a health wealth view of things. That if you're right with God, everything will be well with you. You're right with God, you'll be healthy, wealthy, and wise. There are, of course, people out there preaching that today. This very day, in fact. I'm not going to name them, but I don't think I need to. I don't understand how such a view can make sense of Jesus and the cross. But Job himself holds this view, and it causes a problem for him. Why? There's a disconnect here, because he believes if you suffer, you've done something to deserve it, but he's also aware that he hadn't done anything to deserve what's happened to him. And so he doesn't understand. And so lying behind much of what Job says throughout the book is the question from Job, God, why? I didn't deserve this. Lord, why? I want to look very briefly at a passage where Job is crying out to God so you get a sense for this, and then we'll look at how God responds. Verse 20, Job is speaking, I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up. The idea is I stand up pleading with you. I stand up, but you merely look at me. Have you ever pleaded with somebody? There's something really important to you, and you pleaded with them, and they just stare blankly back at you? Job says, Lord, that's what you're doing to me. I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. Lord, it's not only that you don't respond to me. The more I cry out to you, the worse things get. 23, I know you will bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all the living. What's the point there? I know I'm going to die. Can't we just get it over with? 24, I'm reading from the NIV, I believe. NIV has it this way. Surely no one lays a hand on a broken man when he cries for help in his distress. We would put it this way. You don't kick a man when he's down. And yet, Lord, that's exactly what you seem to be doing to me, seems to be Job's point. And then Job's got what you might call a karma problem. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Look, Lord, I was there for others. You're not here for me now. That doesn't seem right. 26, yet when I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, then came darkness. 27, the churning inside me never stops. You may know what it's like to have anxiety that's so great that your insides churn. Days of suffering confront me. 28, I go about blackened, but not by the sun, apparently a reference to his illness. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. Question, what assembly? Answer, the assembly of God's people. Not only when he's crying out does he not sense that God is responding to him, but God's people have shunned him too. Now, why have they shunned him? Well, they've shunned him precisely because they think he's done something to deserve this and God's mad at him. And if they're kind to him, they might make God mad at them too. They don't want that. And so they shun him. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. 29, I become a brother of jackals, a companion of owls. Some translations have ostriches rather than owls. I won't go into this. That's irrelevant to my concerns at the moment. When I first read this, I thought the point was I'm up all night howling. But I don't think that's Job's point. Jackals and owls / ostriches are unclean animals. They're scavengers. They're unclean. His point is, I cry out to the assembly of your people for help, but they treat me like I'm unclean. They will have nothing to do with me. It's not just that you're not there for me, God, neither are your people. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My harp is tuned to mourning, and my flute to the sound of wailing. Believe it or not, I am paying attention to the clock. Doesn't mean I'll do anything about it, but I am paying attention to it. Rather than read another passage or two in which Job cries out to God, I want to look at God's response. Right? Job cries out, Lord, I call upon you, I cry out to you, I plead with you, you don't respond. In fact, Lord, it's worse than that. The more I cry out to you, the worse things get. God, you don't kick a man when he's down, and yet that's just what you're doing. I was there for others, but you're not there for me, and neither are your people. And I think the question is, underlying all of this, Lord, why? I don't understand. And remember, the text started by telling us he's blameless, he's upright. So when Job thinks to himself, I didn't deserve this, he's right according to the text. The most remarkable thing about the book is not what Job experiences, it's not what he says when he cries out to God, it's what God says in response. So I want to look at that briefly. Chapter 38, then the Lord answered Job out of the storm, and he said, so here's what the Lord says to Job. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Who's speaking ignorantly? Right? Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Verse 4, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. I got to be honest with you. The first time I read this passage seriously in light of the rest of the book, I cringed. I mean, Job, who's a righteous man, who loves the Lord, suffers incredibly, and in the midst of his suffering, he cries out to God, God, why? And God's response was, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? That doesn't strike me, at least initially, as great bedside manner. I think the problem is it's easy to lose tone of voice in a written text. God's making a point to Job, and I want to talk about what that point is. But first, I want to look at chapter 40, where the Lord again responds to Job, and in a different way, I think, makes the same point to him. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's, and can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring him low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. Okay, so back up. Job, who's righteous, endures incredible suffering. And in the midst of his suffering, he cries out to the God he serves. God, why? And God's response is, okay, Job, you want to know why? But before I answer you, let me ask you a couple questions. Were you there when I laid the earth's foundations? Can you make the proud man humble? What's God's point? I think God's point is this. God, why? Well, Job, before I answer that, let me ask you, were you there when I laid the earth's foundations? No, Lord. Okay. Because you know I did that. Yes, Lord. But you don't understand that, do you? No, Lord. Okay. Job, help me out here. Can you make the proud man humble? Because you know I can do that. No, Lord, I can't. Oh, okay. So, Job, you want to know why, but you don't understand the creation of the world. You don't understand how it is that I can make the proud humble. Job, you want to know why, but if you don't understand those things, what makes you think you'd understand this? I take it God's point to Job is, Job, you want to know why? I could tell you why, but you wouldn't understand it because you're not me. So trust me. Job seeks a reason from God, and God says very pointedly, I'm not going to give you a reason. But the Lord gives him something better. I'm not going to give you a reason, but I'll give you me. I'm not going to give you a reason, but I'll give you a relationship. The reason I think this is the point God is making to Job is I think if you look at the last chapter of Job, this is how Job has understood God. 42, verse 1. Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Look at what Job says. Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Listen to what Job says. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Lord, why? Job, I could tell you, but you wouldn't understand. So trust me. And Job says, that is enough. Why does God allow the things he allows? Why did he allow Nick's son to be killed at such a relatively young age in a mountain climbing accident? Why did he allow Margaret to be blown up, literally, over Africa? Why did he allow Judy to go through the deep waters she went through? Why did the end come to Nancy in the way that it did? If we're honest, here's how we reply to that question. Why did God allow those things? We don't know. Because who are we to say why God does anything except God tell us? I grew up in Dallas. There's a loop around Dallas called 635. Today it's about a 24-hour parking lot. But when I was a kid, you could go fast on it at least in the middle of the night. Andrea grew up on one end of 635, West End. I grew up more on the East End. So when we were dating, I used to drive 635 quite a lot back and forth from my parents' home to her parents' home. We were dating. One night I left her parents' home to go back to my parents' home. It was probably 1 a.m. And I got on 635, the loop. And I was able to go at that time pretty fast. I was probably doing 60, 65 at least. It's late at night, obviously dark, it's 1 a.m, you know, I'm driving. I notice in my rearview mirror a car behind me. And it's really far behind me. When I first notice it, it's just two little pinpricks of light in the rearview mirror. But I notice it because the car is driving erratically. And those two little tiny pinpricks are getting bigger and bigger very quickly. I mean, I'm not going slow, but this car behind me is coming up on me fast and weaving in and out of traffic. And cars around it, I can tell, are having to, you know, swerve to keep from being hit. And so in a moment of rare clarity for me, especially at that time of my life, I thought, I'll take the next exit, let this car go by and get back on. So that's what I did, took the next exit. And sure enough, as I'm on the exit ramp exiting, the car goes flying by me. And as the car goes flying by me, I realize I know that car. In fact, not only do I know that car, even though he was a blur as he went by, I recognize the driver. It's my father. What am I going to conclude? Some people might conclude from watching him that he's a reckless maniac who doesn't care about anyone else. But I'm not going to conclude that. What am I going to conclude? I'm going to conclude that my dad has a good reason for driving the way he's driving, even if I don't know what it is. I know my dad's got a good reason. Why? Because I know my dad. It might be reasonable for other people to come to different conclusions about him, but not me. Shouldn't surprise us as unbelievers look at God as a cosmic maniac. Shouldn't surprise us at all. They don't know him. But we who are his people know him. And we don't have to know what his reasons are for allowing us to suffer, to know both that he's got reasons and that they're good ones, because we know him.